This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Let's turn now to Carol Carlson with the Post Tribune. She's written a number of stories, a lot of them are basically related to the same topic, which of course comes down to the Gary Community School Corporation, but in particular with the emergency management team, who is on it, who's in charge and all. And now we've got a couple of state lawmakers that are involved in all of this as well, too. And as always, Carol, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Chris.
Well, let's start first here and talk about the whole situation, because you've been able to cover it almost from the beginning in a way, about the revelation that there is a connection to past leadership within the Indiana Department of Education and the company that is now the consultant managing emergency manager for the Gary School Corporation. Tell us where Tony Bennett fits into all of this.
I learned toward the end of November that there was a connection between Tony Bennett and MGT Consulting of America, which is the company that won the contract to manage the Gary Community School Corp last year, and kind of got that tip. And when I looked into it, I found out that Tony Bennett was indeed on the board of directors of MGT, and I talked to Dr. Bennett, and he confirmed that he was on their board of directors and that the company had been acquired, that company being MGT, had been acquired by another company that Bennett was a partner in. And mm-hmm. by virtue of that acquisition, he became a member of the MGT board of directors.
Has he had any link that you can tell to the contract itself going out to MGT and in turn with the state working up the emergency management team for the Gary schools?
He says he has no day-to-day involvement in the operation of the school district. Now, I was told by Courtney Schaffsma, who's the executive director of the state board that awarded the contract, that she was aware that Bennett was involved with MGT. She said that played absolutely no role in MGT getting the contract.
Now, we know that Tony Bennett has been linked up, of course, primarily in the Mitch Daniels administration. This was when he was still the governor, long before he became the president of Purdue University. And so Tony Bennett's name is not exactly sterling as far as the folks in the Gary Community School Corporation or the community of Gary is concerned. I know even the mayor is not real happy with all of this.
It was under Tony Bennett that the takeover of Roosevelt High School took place by the state, and specifically by Tony Bennett. Roosevelt had earned 6 straight years of F grades, and according to state law, it was ripe for a state takeover. Now, other schools have found themselves in that position, and there haven't been takeovers. There have been other measures taken to work with those schools. And in this case, and in the case of 4 other schools in Indianapolis, Bennett decided to take the schools over, and by so doing, it left Roosevelt with a private education manager to try to turn the school around.
Mm-hmm. Now, this goes up now, of course, now to 2018, we have the situation now with the emergency manager team in. Where does it seem now as far as the state representatives and city representatives in Gary? What do they think about this this link here that apparently goes back to when there were problems earlier in the school corporation?
Well, our story about Bennett's connection to MGT landed with a big thud on them. They were pretty surprised. And they immediately started calling for the contract to be rescinded because they felt that Bennett's policies were one of the prime reasons that Gary began losing enrollment and funding.
Well, you mentioned that in fact, one of the latest stories that you had here involving State Representative Vernon Smith putting in his feelings about the situation, and he in particular joining State Senator Eddie Melton in asking for some changes. Let's bring things together there, if you will, and talk about first how Senator Melton has gotten involved in this, and in turn now how State Representative Vernon Smith has gotten involved.
Melton and Smith both played a role in the current status of the school district. Melton was one of the co-sponsors of the district-wide takeover legislation in 2017 that led to the arrival of MGT. And Vernon Smith himself has been a longtime educator, retired principal in the Gary School, so their operation is he's quite familiar with it.
Mm-hmm.
He also sits on the State Education Committee as a state lawmaker, and he's a non-voting advisory member of the state board that awarded the contract to MGT.
Now, I get the impression, and you probably have too, that even though this has come up here ahead of the General Assembly session that begins in January, there may be some changes, at least something talked about there in the halls of the State House about all this?
Well, it is going to be up to the General Assembly to fund the third year of MGT's contract.
Mm-hmm.
And because the General Assembly is Republican-dominated to the point where both houses have supermajorities, it doesn't seem very likely that they're going to dump MGT at this point, and especially now that the turnaround is, you know, basically square in the middle of it and starting back with another company at, you know, the beginning again. I just don't think that's going to happen.
We're talking with Carol Carlson with the Post Tribune about stories that she's had out online and in print here in the Post Tribune lately, and they have been lately focusing on the Gary Community School Corporation and the emergency management team. One of the other stories that you have out there is the update on the changeover, I guess, of the management team, in particular, as one person retires and another person is hired. Tell us where Peggy Hinckley stands and where now the successor to Peggy as the emergency manager is.
Well, Hinckley announced her retirement seemingly kind of abruptly last month, and at that press conference, former Griffith Public Schools Superintendent Peter Marikas was announced as her successor to be the emergency manager of the school district.
Now, what does Dr. Marikas have to say here about the situation that he's stepped into now?
He is kind of in the learning process right now. He's visiting all the schools. He's listening to teachers. He said he's listening to custodians and bus drivers and everybody he can find to learn about what employees perceive as some of the issues that they face. And he says he's in it for the long haul. He's not going anywhere. And he has a passion for children and helping them succeed in whatever way he can.
Now, what do members of the Gary Community School Corporation Board, which we know has virtually no power now because of the changeover law, what do they have to say with the change in the emergency management team and teachers and parents, for that matter, too?
I haven't heard much from them. Nellie Moore, who is the current school board president, although she plans to resign next week, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She said she was not surprised at learning about the Bennett connection, and she said that education consultants seem to be the ones benefiting most from some of the failures we're seeing in public education.
Does she seem to think that Dr. Marikas is going to help since he's taken over pretty much now for Dr. Hinckley?
She's hopeful. She didn't have much, she hasn't been very negative about Dr. Hinckley. I think they had a good relationship, and
yeah.
I think that Nellie said she plans to continue even after her resignation in volunteering and helping the school district in whatever way she can. So I'm sure she'll work with Dr. Marikas to try to improve the school district.
And what impression do you get from some of the teachers, either currently employed by the Gary Schools or retired or used to be on the payroll? What do they seem to think about the changeover and for Dr. Marikas to take over?
They were surprised that it happened when it happened. I mean, perhaps at the end of the school year, you might expect a retirement to take place.
Right.
And they really didn't have much to say about it other than surprise.
One of the other stories, too, which is related to all this, and something, too, I guess it may even actually, I suppose, later come up as a General Assembly topic, is the matter of teachers' pay. And in particular, you did a story here that was in the Post Tribune in print and online about the Gary School Teachers Union. Where do they stand in all of this as far as the possibility of pay raises, and especially with the contract that they now have?
Well, they've gone 12 years without a raise, they say, and did get a new contract a few weeks ago, but again, it didn't have a raise attached to it. And there is a movement through Senator Eddie Melton to lift up teacher salaries across the state. That would give them, I don't know if it's an additional, I think it's an additional $3,000 annually.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they're hopeful, but I guess that legislation is a long way off right now.
Yeah, it seems to be. It certainly wouldn't be introduced until the General Assembly comes back into session in January. And is it your impression, from what you know about all of the situation, and even though that we know very little right now about what Senator Melton's proposal is going to be like, is there a possibility that if his proposal is looking statewide at giving teachers a raise, that some of that money may go to the Gary Community School teachers, rather, even though the contract they're in right now doesn't call for one?
Well, I think if there is a raise statewide, they would certainly be able to tap into that.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, school board member Robert Buggs criticize the incentive awards that the state has been giving MGT for basically trimming Gary's debt, and he said maybe some of that money should be given to the teachers who are, you know, working to do the same thing on the front lines.
So some of that funding may come back in one way or the other, I guess, whether it's directly from the result of any bill that goes before the General Assembly to paring away some of the money that the contractor, the consulting contractor, is getting. So
mm-hmm.
It'll be interesting to see what gets developed. And you're right, we just have to wait and see whatever that Senator Melton's bill, what kind of reception it receives from his colleagues in the Senate, as well as over across the aisle, so to speak, in the Indiana House. They have to approve it, too, and then goes on to the governor in whatever form it's going to turn into. And we'll have to wait and see what comes about and whether any teachers here in Gary manage to join their colleagues elsewhere in the state and do picking up some kind of raise, to be sure. We've been talking with Carol Carlson, who is a reporter and writer for the Post Tribune in Gary and in Northwest Indiana. She covers educational issues, and lately she's been covering a number of stories for the Gary Community School Corporation. And as always, Carol, thank you very much for joining us and for bringing us the updates.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
This is Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The Lake County Council, as far as we know, has never had a meeting outside of the Lake County Government Complex. Maybe not in their own room. They may have gone to the auditorium for a meeting, especially if they expected a really big crowd. But this time, they're actually going out of the building and back to their original home. That is to say, the historic Lake County Courthouse in downtown Crown Point. And we find out more about this one-time-only special meeting that the Lake County Council is going to have outside of the Government Center. Coming up here, Gary Napoleon is the managing director of the Lake Courthouse Foundation, and she is with us to talk about it. Gary, thank you very much for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Tell us a little bit about what, I guess, the Lake County Council would do during their meetings, and why, in this particular case, they're taking the day off from being in the Government Center up on the north end of Crown Point and coming back downtown.
Well, it's just an opportunity to get back to county government's roots. You know, I worked for the Post Tribune for a while and covered county government, and after I took this job with the Courthouse Foundation, Councilman Dan Dernol had come to the building for some unrelated business and just saw how beautiful it is, and it really is a beautiful structure. So we started talking, and you know, he posed the idea, what if we came back? So we worked on it a bit, him, Dave Hamm, and we kind of made it all happen, and we're really excited to have them. But I have to point out, they won't be meeting where they originally met.
Yeah.
Back in the 70s. The room is very small.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you figured it up. It's like 670 square feet. Now, that's barely enough room to breathe, much less to house all the people that normally show up to a county government meeting like that.
Yes, I can't even imagine how they fit everybody in there. I mean, the three commissioners, could have sat behind the dais really nicely. But for the whole county council, I'm not sure where they all fit when they were in there.
Uh-huh.
And I do know I had spoken with Bill Dolan from the Times regarding this, and he had actually covered county government when it was back at our court building, our courthouse building,
right,
and said people would be standing in the hallway trying to peer in because it was so crowded.
Well, and probably people, too, that if they happen to have items on the agenda, they were out there waiting for their turn to come in the building, come into the room anyway.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. And now that room we actually use as the bar area for our ballroom. We converted the Auditor's Treasurer's office in the 80s into the Mackey Ballroom, mm-hmm. and that former commissioner's courtroom, which still all has its original wood, it's a beautiful space, but it's the bar for the ballroom now.
Well, this very special one-time-only official event that is coming up with the Lake County Council is going to be on December 11th, and it will be held in a very beautiful room of its own right. We're talking about the old courtroom. For folks that have never been upstairs on the third floor to see this room, describe the room for us, what's there, and how it fits into the great history of the grand old lady, that is to say the old Lake County Courthouse.
The courtroom is spectacular. This is the circuit courtroom. It was added in the first expansion, or it was enlarged, I should say, in the first expansion in 1909. All the seating is original in there. It's truly beautiful. We use it now. Crown Point City Court was there until about 2 years ago. Now we use it exclusively for wedding ceremonies. Currently we have a play in there, Dickens of a Christmas, last weekend, this weekend. So it's set up with a stage for the play. So come Sunday afternoon, we have to start working to get it ready for Tuesday so we can have the dais set up for the county council to come back in the room. It really is spectacular. It has the 16-foot windows. It's just a gorgeous space.
Now, overall, for the entire building, it's of course, a spectacular building for anyone who has not gone downtown in Crown Point to take a look at it or gone inside to check out the various rooms that have been converted over time from county government offices into the different functions of the courthouse now. But I know that the history of the marriage mill, as it's been called and is noted so in the history books, is certainly part of the old courtroom itself, isn't it?
Yes, it's my understanding that there was always a judge on duty in the building who can conduct weddings. Back in the marriage mill day, it cost $2 to get a marriage license, and the Lake County Courthouse was open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to perform the services, or to issue the marriage licenses.
Yeah.
And then there were the justices of the peace around the square who also married people. So there were quite a few people that come through there, and there are quite a few people now that still come through there. I mean, we typically have weddings there on most Fridays and Saturdays.
And we know, too, that there's always history in the marriage mill. There have been some very notable people who have, of all places, you would think, to be married, would have come to Crown Point, Indiana, and to the historic courthouse to be married. Who are some of the famous people that have tied the knot, so to speak, in the courthouse there?
Well, of course, we had Muhammad Ali. Cassius Clay was married there. Michael Jackson's parents were married in the courthouse. Joe DiMaggio obtained his marriage license there and was married in the courthouse, though not to Marilyn Monroe. Rudy Valentino was also married in the courthouse. There's just a large number of people. We understand that Ronald Reagan received his marriage license there, but was not married at the building.
Yeah. That was back when he was engaged to marry Jane Wyman, right?
That's
his
my
first wife.
Yeah.
His first wife. So that's an interesting note for history as well too. Fast forward to December 11th. As far as you know, besides getting things set up for the county council meeting, have they got planned for that room that day?
Well, hopefully, we have a lot of folks from the community show up. We're really proud of the building and would like to kind of share what we have there to show people around. We'll be providing tours that day. We'll have some coffee and refreshments for anybody who shows up. And the council will be conducting its regular business meeting. So it will take the normal amount of time that it usually does. I'm sure they have, I haven't seen an agenda, but I'm sure they have a lot of business to conduct being end of year and all. So it should be an interesting day.
Is there any reason why they happened to pick this particular meeting, I guess, to hold this historic one-time-only meeting outside of the county government center?
Timing, and it's past budget season. While we were in budget season when we originally started talking about this, all those meetings are set well in advance, and you really can't change anything when it comes to dealing with the budget. So this was a little easier. It was notified 2 months ago, so people had time to make the adjustment. And it technically, they say that this isn't as busy of an agenda at the end of the year, but they're always busy.
Now, I know that you are responsible for taking care of arranging these events that come up here inside the historic Lake County Courthouse, but obviously I'm sure that your board of the Lake Courthouse Foundation is very interested in wanting to use this opportunity, a chance to do a little fundraising, I imagine, or at least attract people to the room and to the rest of the courthouse itself to take a look at it and be able to get the financial support that you need to be able to keep that great lady up and keep her running.
Definitely. People see the Crown Point Courthouse and think, oh, it's always been there. You know, it's a beautiful structure. It looks fantastic. But it's important to remember this is a 140-year-old building. We marked our 140th birthday this year. And every day there is something. It needs constant maintenance and restoration, or it's not going to last into the future. So it's an ongoing battle to keep the funds coming in, to keep things up to date, keep things improved, keep things moving. So the more awareness we raise about this, the more people we bring into the building so they feel a connection to it. It was easy in the 70s because people had been through there a lot. Now, unless you're invited to a wedding or if you shop in our shops, you may not see the second and third floor. A lot of people do go downstairs to the shops. We are at full occupancy down there and decorated for the holidays, so it's a really exciting time down there. But people often don't travel upstairs and see just the beautiful marble work, the engraving, the founders of the county who are engraved in the walls. It's really an interesting building.
Now, you mentioned here at the beginning of our conversation that you're going to be doing some brief conversion, I guess, or changing back of the old courthouse courtroom upstairs from a holiday play to be able to accommodate this very special one-time-only official Lake County Council meeting on the 11th. Can you give us an idea off the top of your head what's on the list of events happening after they have this special meeting?
We're a little quiet in January with weddings and things coming up. We're busy this weekend. We have the last weekend of the play, and we also have a breakfast with Santa on Saturday. It's the first time we've done something like that. We want an opportunity to let people who haven't seen the Mackey Ballroom come in. If you're not invited for a wedding, we really don't have, you can't come there just to eat dinner. So having an event like this and opening it up to the public gives everybody a chance to kind of come in and experience that aspect of our building. And then we have a book signing coming in February. We have a lecture series in partnership with the Crown Point Library coming in March. We're very excited about that because that uses the courtroom again. The courtroom is a perfect space. It seats approximately 170 people, so it's a perfect space for lunch and learns. We have a space that you can have lunch catered in afterwards or for your meetings. So, you know, we're just hoping to expose people to that so they use this building and help us keep it running because they're using it.
Well, this is a one-time event happening on Tuesday, December 11th. It's the Lake County Council having a one-time special official meeting in a place where they used to have official meetings all the time, which, of course, is the historic Lake Courthouse in downtown Crown Point. And, Carrie, thank you very much for telling us about this and all the preparations that you and others are making for this special event coming up with the Lake County Council and all the things coming up in the future there at the courthouse. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much. You have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too. We're talking with Carrie Napoleon. She's the managing director of the Lake Courthouse Foundation. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. And this Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's check in on some perspective on business news around the state. Insiders offers perspective on this week's top stories on Inside Indiana Business with Gary Dick Television. This week, Gary is joined by guest Indy Politics publisher Abdul Akeem Shabazz from Katz Corin Dunham, co-founding partner Norris Cunningham, and Mary Beth Oakes, who is the CEO of Business Furniture. They're sounding off on a newly formed tech organization that's advocating for public policy. The Indiana Chamber is out with its legislative priorities for 2019, and we'll also hear a Business of Health report from Inside Indiana Business reporter Kylie Valletta.
And welcome one and all to the Insiders.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
For another week. And Abdul, our resident legislative guru, and you were down there, I know, for Organizational Day. the technology sector has long, people have talked about that group as a group not having an advocacy, a policy group. That is changing now with the creation of the Indiana Technology and Innovation Association. Good move?
Very good move. When you look at, you know, just how Indiana has grown over the past 10 years, particularly in the technology field, whether it's, you know, Infosys or whether it's Salesforce, just some of the other, you know, 16 tech in Indianapolis, other some of the tech hubs that just sort of sprout all over the place, it only makes sense that the tech people have, you know, a public policy advocacy group to explain, you know, a lot of these issues to a lot of lawmakers that aren't who just got off MySpace, you know, not too long ago, and have discovered social media. So no, I think it's really good and a really smart move for the tech industry.
And the timing, maybe that with the momentum in the tech community, a good time to do it.
It's almost kind of shocking that it took this long for this to happen, right? But I think I'm like you. I think it's a great move, very timely. Needed to happen. They need a voice. They need somebody that can really inform the legislators about what needs to happen and how it should happen, why it should happen. So.
And also, Norris, as you try to attract more, keep more talent, attract talent here, some of these issues, taxation issues and issues around talent, legislatively, those can be important moves.
Well, exactly right. And so now they can focus on their own legislative priorities, right? There's a political action committee that comes along with this. And so they're going to have an opportunity, I think, to start influencing policy on the front end rather than sort of being reactive, I think, the way the tech industry has been in the past.
And just to piggyback on that, if you look at some of the issues we've had to deal with the last couple of years, whether it was like how do you regulate Uber, you know, Airbnb,
right.
I know, and even to a lesser degree, you know, scooters, you know, all over the place, as this new technology pops up, it's good for the technology people to have an advocacy group that can explain to lawmakers, here's why, you know, self-driving cars are what they are.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk about legislative priorities. A number of organizations and groups out with their legislative agenda in the week just ended. The Indiana Chamber of Commerce business advocacy, obviously, will focus on areas like hate crime legislation. Also back to cigarette taxes, Abdul, a $2 increase per pack. Didn't work last time. You think they'll have more success this time?
They might. We did the politics poll at the U.S. Senate race this past October. We also asked about a $2 increase in the cigarette tax. And oddly enough, had like 62% support for an increase in the cigarette tax. Now, whether lawmakers will follow along, that remains to be seen. I know the speaker at the event afterwards talked about maybe like a dollar, you know, increase might be sort of the way to start. But with the state also, we found out this week, having some budget issues with revenues maybe falling a little short, a lot more demands, that $2 cigarette tax increase just might actually look really attractive to a lot more people.
Yeah, and from a business community standpoint, the health issues, Indiana unfortunately continues to not do well in those health ratings. Poor health costs businesses money.
It does cost us. I mean, health costs, the healthcare costs are rising so dramatically. And I know every company we work with has a whole initiative around really getting their employees healthier, more proactively, really educating them so they can be good consumers of healthcare. So I think you're right. I think anything we can do to move that along just makes us a better community, more attractive.
Well, the wellness feature, I think, is good on the part of the chamber to be focused on the cigarette tax as a way of being able to do that. I want to take them to task a little bit, though, on their opposition to medical marijuana. I know that that's a priority for the Democrats this legislative session, but 33 states have medicinal use of marijuana now. This is an area where Indiana needs to come into the fold. You know, that's enough states to ratify a constitutional amendment, I think, right? I mean, so that's a pretty good indication that there really is consensus around the efficacy of medical marijuana, and Indiana needs to move in that direction. So the chamber's wrong on that one.
And you look at the data, the evidence on how that really does make a difference, right?
Yes, right.
So I think you're right about that. I do. Yes. I agree.
And interesting that, as you mentioned, the Democrat caucus is out. They want to move or push for legalization of medical marijuana.
Yeah.
Interesting to see how that works out. In terms of the economy, big news this week already had been announced, but a groundbreaking for Infosys in its USA training hub at the old Indianapolis International Airport. A major project, big project, 3,000 jobs committed here. But I think, Mary Beth, interesting that, you know, Infosys is committed to 10,000 jobs in the U.S. And all those people, they will are be, to come through this center.
They'll be touching our economy, right? So it's a great thing for our city, and I think it's a great thing for the West Side. I feel like the West Side has just really had some struggles and some decline, and it's mm-hmm. exciting to see that there's going to be a boost there. Mm-hmm. And I just love it because it's a great, great story about our city, and things did not work out right with Amazon. Mm-hmm. But you look at companies like Infosys, yeah. you know, it's a perfect fit for us, right? It's a perfect opportunity for our city.
Yeah, that West Side development, I think, is key. Being able to use that Air Force space, or that airport space, rather, mm-hmm. in that way, I think, is going to be very good for the West Side. But their mission of training
yes.
and retraining, reskilling, if you will, workers, I think, is something that mm-hmm. That locally mm-hmm. is an important thing for the state of Indiana.
Yeah.
I mean, the tech jobs of the future is going to require highly skilled workers, and we've got a number of folks that probably need to, as manufacturing falls away and falls off, that need that retraining. So this is an excellent opportunity, I think.
And something else what Infosys shows is about a decade ago, former Minneapolis Mayor Greg Ballard took a trip to India, mm-hmm. and a lot of people were wondering, why is he going to India? What's going on there? He's just on a junket, just wasting valuable taxpayer time. It was those types of trips a decade ago that built these relationships
right.
that we're all now
yeah.
finally seeing come to fruition. And I think that's really important for people.
It's a great point. He was really a leader, a visionary in that regard. Abdul, I have to ask you.
Marijuana no, question?
Amazon, close. Okay, Indy didn't get Amazon. Did Indy, as John McDonald from Cloud One, others have said, maybe Indy dodged a bullet by not getting Amazon?
I'm a firm believer that Indianapolis dodged a bullet. If somebody spends a lot of time in Seattle and talks to a lot of the folks out there just about how life has changed in a post-Amazon universe. I mean, everybody loves, you know, talks about, you know, the high-tech and high-wage jobs, but also along with that comes increased housing prices and a bunch of other things that I don't think necessarily Indianapolis was ready for. And we're already dealing with, you know, workforce shortages, you know, as they are. Mm-hmm. And so I think by sort of missing Amazon, it shows that, hey, we can compete with the big guys, but maybe that wasn't necessarily the one that you wanted to land.
It's time now for the Business of Health, brought to you by Hendricks Regional Health. What's for lunch? Well, it's top of mind for Hoosier students every school day, and a handful of Indiana organizations on a mission to make the menu more local. Business of Health reporter Kylie Valletta is here with more. Kylie.
Thank you, Gary. Indiana Grown is part of a team that's working to increase the amount of local food on school lunch menus statewide. The organization connects Indiana farmers and producers with greater opportunities to market and sell their products locally. Indiana Grown for Schools is its newest project, and the group is cooking up a resource guide to help schools connect with local farmers and producers. Indiana Grown Membership Development Program Manager Heather Tallman joins me now to tell us more about the project. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
This guide, sounds a little boring, the concept of it, but it's meant to show what farmers out there want to sell to schools and what they are selling. So why is the guide the first step to make this happen?
Well, there are almost 600 school corporations in the state of Indiana, and each one has a school food service director that really does not have time to chase down and curate all the local food through area like they would like to. And then on the other hand, we have farmers who are making, producing, packaging foods they would like to sell to schools, and they don't know how to have that conversation with those buyers. Our hope is this guide will bridge that gap.
So why do we want our kids to eat locally? Why is that a healthier option?
Well, I think anyone would say that food that comes a shorter distance is probably ideal, whether we're buying it at the grocery store, eating it at a restaurant, or at school. And school lunchrooms, in a lot of ways, are kind of the state's biggest restaurant. And so we just want to try to maybe move the needle a little bit on making that easier for the buyer.
So I have kids and I buy most of the food for our home. Eating local is often more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you make the economics work for schools that are on really tight budgets?
Mm-hmm. The nice thing about this grant and project is that we have partners that can help guide the food service providers on what that looks like between what the USDA and government allows for in their budget, between that and the education that the food service buyers have. But, you know, when you think about economy of scale, when we have a large school corporation physician who's going to set up a routine and a schedule to buy, that will help guide the producer and the farmer to know how to price it. So it's really a conversation starter. We had to start somewhere, and hopefully the guide will be just that.
And you mentioned online also. It's not just the paper guide, but online as well.
Absolutely. It's going to be online. That way it's always going to be fluid and changing as we grow, and then a paper copy that will be dispersed about a year from now.
And your main call to action right now is for those farmers and producers to complete a survey. Tell us about the importance of that.
Absolutely. We don't know what we don't know. So in order to be in the guide that we hand out to all these schools, we need the producer to fill it out. Even if they're maybe kind of on the fence about it, we can maybe help counsel them and educate them on what it would take to go to that next level.
So you mentioned this guide. It could be distributed next fall to the schools. There are nearly 600 school corporations in the state, so this could really drive big business for the farmers.
Absolutely. We really feel like this is going to be an impactful move for Indiana agriculture on the whole. It's something that's relatable to everyone, and I believe there's a way that all different forms of agriculture can be touched in this, from sweet corn to bread to fluid milk. It's a little bit of something for everyone.
And throughout the entire state, county by county.
So a buyer will be able to look at that guide and see not only what's in their county, but what's in their surrounding county.
So in your position, you talk to a lot of farmers, and you say those farmers want to sell to schools, and the schools want to buy from the farmers, but this guide just really helps connect the dots. You're doing the legwork.
Yeah, there are not a lot of conversation guides to kind of help maximize everyone's time. We can't have 10 or 15 farmers showing up at a school saying, look at my greens and my corn. Likewise, we can't have a director feeling like they have to call these different farmers. That's not a good use of their time. We're going to hopefully funnel and navigate that information for them.
Well, Heather, thank you so much for being here. Great project. And hopefully we can get some good food in schools, local food soon.
Yeah,
Thanks for being here.
Inside Indiana Business is Indiana's only statewide business television program. It's on stations in Indianapolis and 13 additional statewide affiliates. And you can find out more about Inside Indiana Business on-air programming by going to their website, which is insideindianabusiness.com, or check out their YouTube channel. Just search for Inside Indiana Business. Vicki Henn is the executive vice president and the chief human resources officer for PNC Financial Services Group. She was a keynote speaker recently for the Michigan City Chamber of Commerce's 100 Inspiring Women Luncheon. And she recently joined Lakeshore Public Radio's Dee Dotson from the Blue Chip Casino Stardust Event Center to talk about her keynote address, and including being a working mother, and she delves into the notion of a good work life balance. Here's the conversation.
As a member of PNC's Corporate Diversity Council, can you tell us how you make the case for diversity in your organization?
So it's interesting that this notion of business case for diversity, honestly, at PNC, I would say it's an essential part of our talent-focused culture. So we don't treat diversity and inclusion as a separate program. It's part of our talent strategy. And so in order to have the highest performing, best talent that we can have, frankly, that requires us to have a diverse team, and it requires us to have an inclusive culture, an inclusive environment where people want to work. So our Corporate Diversity Council is very, very focused on working with my team in human resources to create talent-focused strategies that help us to attract diverse talent, and then most importantly, retain diverse talent in the organization, so that we have a pipeline of talent for future leadership positions across the board.
Since the Michigan City Chamber of Commerce Luncheon is all about 100 inspiring women and their contributions to the chamber, what are some of the ways you have benefited from or worked with female advocates in advancing your career?
Well, women supporting women is important and has been important for me, certainly. So it's probably been less about, people ask me, have I had mentors or have I been part of programs? Those are really important parts of dynamic cultures. I would say for me personally, it's always been having women that either I worked with or that I worked for, that sometimes worked for me, that I could learn from, that took an interest in me, that offered me coaching, that sometimes pushed me when I didn't have a lot of confidence in myself. And so I'm a big believer just in the support network of women, and by the way, looking for coaches wherever they might be. So I try and really focus the women that work in our organization, not just to think about, the women above them in leadership positions, but some of the best advice, the best coaching, the best support I've received over my 25 years at PNC have been from the women that I work with. you know, from the women that work for me. So you have to be willing to be open and looking for that coaching and support wherever you can find it. And then to provide it to others as well. I think it's a real gift we can give to each other.
2018 has been dubbed the Year of the Woman, with a record number of women elected to the U.S. House of Representatives. You are about to deliver a keynote address to 100 inspiring women. What woman or women inspire you and why?
That's a great question. I should have thought of that before you asked me. You know, I can't, it would be hard for me to think of one woman. I think that certainly when I think about the female caregivers that I know, who not only are inspiring, you know, day to day from a professional perspective, but are also people that are involved in their community, that are taking care of whether it's elderly parents, whether it's children, what have you. I think those are the women that are most inspiring, women who, frankly, give of themselves in all facets of their life. That's been very inspiring for me, and something that, honestly, I've looked to in my career. This notion of work-life balance, I think, is a bit of a fallacy and puts a lot of pressure on us, because it's hard to balance everything. You can't do everything really well at one time. But the people that have inspired me, the women that have inspired me, are women who, frankly, do the best they can in the situation they're in at any given time, and just every day have that same sort of discipline and that same approach to their life. So some days it might be they're giving their all professionally. Other days they might be giving their all to a friend who is in need, or a you know, somebody who's sick, or a community group that needs their help. Those are the women that inspire me. And frankly, that's what I try to emulate myself in my leadership and in my life as well.
It is both timely as well as interesting that you brought up the conversation around the whole work-life balance for women being a fallacy. In Michelle Obama's book, Becoming, she challenges Facebook executive Sheryl Sandberg in her book, Lean In, about women being able to do it all. So it's great to hear it from not only a former first lady, but it is also refreshing and almost reassuring to hear it from you.
It is funny. I remember when Lean In came out, and I would make that comment, you know, so some people loved it, embraced it, and other people told me I should go read her book, which I said, I have read her book. No disrespect. And by the way, I don't think Sheryl Sandberg probably appreciated or meant for it to come off the way it did at the time either. But the truth of the matter is, and I think it's for anybody, you know, there's no such thing as perfect balance. And our ability to talk about it and to be open about it and to be more transparent is half the battle, right? Because I think that if we set up these ideas that a woman should be able to do everything flawlessly, then we're part of the problem. So I'm very open. You know, I have 4 children. I've got a big job. I'm very involved at home, involved in my community. And every day something suffers, right? So some days I have to be, you know, 80% of me is at work and my kids only get 20%. But those are choices I make. And I do the best I can every day to balance. And every week is different. Every day is different. And I think we have to support each other and just appreciate that. And you know, that's how we can help each other thrive. That's how we can help each other be successful. And that's what inspires me.
And finally, Vicki, what is the one leadership lesson that you've learned in your career that you would like to share with other inspiring women?
The one lesson for me that I do think tends to be, from a gender perspective, I think a bit more acute in females is, I wish I had learned earlier not to make assumptions. So I had a real issue, I would say, earlier in my career with, you know, if someone didn't say hello to me when I was walking by them, if I was in a meeting and someone wasn't overly enthusiastic about an idea I had, I immediately became very self-conscious and assumed that I must have done something wrong. I must not be working hard enough. And I immediately thought, very self-centered, actually, as I think back about it, you know, it had to be about me. I never really appreciated that, hey, maybe someone's having a bad day. Maybe someone's got a lot on their mind, right? It's not. And I lost a lot of time. I think I spent a lot of wasted energy caring a little bit too much and assuming a little too much that I must be doing something wrong. I must not be working hard enough. And I wish I had learned earlier in my career and in life in general, by the way, this is just a life lesson for me, to take things as they are, right? If you know you're doing good work, if you're working hard, if you're being a kind person, a good person, all you can do is control yourself. And you have to hope that people will see that. And if you feel in a moment that that's not being reciprocated, it doesn't have to be about you. It could be about other things going on, and not to get paralyzed by that. I wish I had learned that earlier.
That's Vicki Hinn, Executive Vice President and Chief Human Resources Officer for the PNC Financial Services Group. Thank you, Vicki, for spending time with us today.
Okay, thank you.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week on this Reporters Roundtable Thursday. Our thanks to Carol Carlson from the Post Tribune and also from the Lake Courthouse Foundation. Our conversation with Carrie Napoleon, to Lakeshore Public Radio's Dee Dodson, and from Inside Indiana Business to Gary Dick and to Kylie Valletta. And thank you for joining us. We'll be back with you on Monday.